SBS Audio is supported by advertising.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, you get to the airport and you're too late for the plane and you've missed it by 5 minutes. Do you have a total panic attack or do you reassess and make a new decision and you experience a death? That was a death of that plan, you know? And I think that's practicing dying.
Welcome to our last episode of Grave Matters, a lively and very musical look at death.
All of us at Grave Matters would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land we are recording from. We pay our respects to the Cammeraygal people and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge the traditional owners from all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander lands you are listening from.
A warning, this episode contains references to death and conversations about drug use. Please take care.
Nadine Giuseppina Cohen, hola.
Hola, ¿cómo está?
Va bene?
You forget I actually speak Spanish.
I know, and I speak Italian.
We can
so
go for ages.
Yeah, well.
Can you believe it's our last episode?
I can, almost. We did it.
We did it, against all odds.
What odds?
All the odds. You know, those odds that we had. Anyway, today we're changing the vibe a little with someone you probably never expected to find on a death podcast. In our final, super fun episode, we talked to Ben Lee. Yes, that Ben Lee. Discovered at a library book sale and sausage sizzle in 1992, Ben Lee has written and recorded music ever since, winning multiple ARIA awards on the way. He's toured the world, acted in films, advocated for psychedelics, run the Weirder Together podcast network with his wife Ione Sky, and thrown many excellent parties. What is he doing on a death podcast? You're about to find out. Hi, Ben.
Hello there.
You're a man of many talents.
Questionable, but yes, okay.
Musician, producer, writer, podcaster, seeker, adventurer. Did I miss anything?
No, that's okay. I mean, I can, you know, I make a nice cup of tea too. You know, awesome. I don't know what that's called professionally, but you know.
Before we get into how a musician got into this area of becoming a qualified death doula, can you briefly tell our listeners what a death doula is, or death midwife, whatever you prefer to call it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it seems to be a bit of an evolving craft in a sense. So I think the definition is continuing to change as a society we get a little more comfortable, hopefully once again, with incorporating death into our life. Because, you know, there used to be a time where when grandma died, she'd be in the living room and everyone would come and visit her. And there was that, you know, and it really all changed in America around the time of the Civil War, when people were dying further from home and then they had to be embalmed. And it started becoming a medical process to move the body back and forth. So anyway, that's a long answer to say that my understanding of death midwifery or being a death doula is simply someone that's there for the person who's dying or for the family. It might be more in service of the people around, to help just ease the process along as the same way a birth doula, a birth midwife would.
And how did you come to, you know, wanting to equip yourself with those skills?
Yeah, well, for me, it all came about through my experiences with psychedelics. I was doing sort of volunteer work in assisting with ayahuasca ceremonies so I wouldn't be, you know, I'd done a lot of ceremonies as a participant, but also would regularly sort of be a helper.
Ayahuasca is a plant-based psychoactive tea traditionally used by indigenous cultures in South America for shamanistic ceremonies and healing. It is also used recreationally in ceremonies all over the world and is believed by many to treat certain physical ailments, addictions, and mood disorders.
It was an interesting job because you're walking around basically while people are in the midst of incredibly deep and often difficult confrontations with themselves and with their own conscience and with their fears and desires. And you know, there were physical things you could help with, like if someone needed to go to the toilet, you could help them because they might be a bit wobbly and, you know, guide them along to the bathroom, or someone might need a drink of water. Mm. Also, sometimes someone just needs some company. They just need their hand held for a scary moment. So things like that would happen. But there was a growing realization in me that in some ways, the experience of sitting with somebody who was on psychedelics was both the most intimate thing you could do with somebody, but also the most helpless, because really they were just facing themselves. And what was really required was your ability to bear witness and kind of just hold space for them to have whatever experience they were having. And you couldn't really dictate or change what that was.
The effects of ayahuasca can be extremely intense, mentally and physically. So sober guides or helpers are often present to support people through the experience.
Yeah, I know there are people in the psychedelic realm that more consider like there are guides and all that that try and shape experiences, but that was never my interest. My interest was in how people could have their own experiences and confront what they needed to confront. So I just started thinking a lot about like what was the skill set of being with somebody while they're going through a very intense personal experience that you can't necessarily fix. And, you know, there was a lot of conversation and theory and ideas going back a very long time about the connection between psychedelics and death. There was a beautiful book that really influenced me by Timothy Leary and also by Ram Dass when he was Richard Alpert at Harvard. And that was a reinterpretation of the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. And it really moved me because it made me, they really equated the idea that to have a psychedelic experience that was as helpful as possible, you had to die. You had to let yourself die. You had to let go.
Look, there's a lot to unpack here, but Ram Dass was an American spiritual teacher, researcher, and Harvard psychologist with a special interest in psychedelics. The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, written by Sogyal Rinpoche in 1992, is an interpretation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead from the 14th century.
So I just started wanting to get better at all of this stuff, and I just started to want to be a better friend, because I was always a bit like, I guess I'm a bit like dominating as a personality. Like I talk a lot and I can be loud, and I realized that in some ways I wasn't great at just holding space for people going through things. And so all of that led me into how can I get these skills? What can I learn? And it just all, I can't remember the exact moment, but it really led to me wanting to understand how to volunteer with people who were dying and what I could learn from that experience.
And it was that exactly what led you straight into volunteering at the hospice?
Yeah. Well, I did a course with a woman called Olivia Barham in LA, in Topanga, called Sacred Crossings. She was actually running a small hospice, and it was a series. It was a great course and involved where we had to also learn how to, you know, everything like from how much dry ice you need to keep a body not decomposing if you wanted to have a period in the house where, you know, all of these things that have sort of become like you almost giggle now because they're so taboo in our society. Mm. I remember one of the most beautiful things I learned was that everybody is going to have their own personal approach to the period before their death, right? You know, when I started doing hospice volunteering, there were some people that wanted to have very profound conversations and it was very meaningful and they had stuff they were working through from their life and they wanted to reconnect with family members or they had reflections. And other people wanted to watch reruns of Cheers. And almost, I would say, the biggest lesson that I learned in all of this death, midwifery, and hospice volunteering was that it's not your job to dictate what a good death is, that your job is basically to be the person that holds the menu, and however this person wants to have their experience, you're just there to support them and be there with them through it.
I wonder if we can kind of segue into a related question, because I know you're not working professionally in this space, but you think very deeply about these issues. And even though you might not call yourself
a death doula, I've heard you say that the skill set you need to be a death doula is the same skill set you need to tuck your daughter in at night. I wonder if you can tell us what you mean by that.
Well, I just mean that it's presumptuous to think that you can solve anybody else's fear. When you tuck your kid into bed and they're scared of the dark, it's dismissive and it's reductive and it's condescending to tell them not to be afraid or that there's nothing to be afraid of, because humans having a fear response in front of darkness, in front of the unknown, is one of the healthiest responses we can have. That's actually incredibly, it's a huge part of self-preservation. And as a species, we've needed that. We need to be scared of the unknown. But there is a lot of courage that comes from sitting with people who allow you to have those feelings and believe that you can kind of have the experience anyway.
I feel like that's a nice point at which to talk about being a parent and talking to your kids about death and dying. Your daughter, how old is she now?
She's now 13 and a half, yeah.
And I imagine along the way she's asked you about things that have happened and wanted you to explain to her, or your wife to explain to her, what death is and where people go. How has the work that you've done in this space helped to inform your ability to have those conversations with your kids?
Yeah, well, me and Ione actually had a fight about this once, because when Goldie was like five or something, she said, there was some talk of death. I can't remember. Maybe the dog had died or something. And she said, "Mom, I'm not going to die, am I?" And Ione looked at her and went, "No." And I was just like, you're literally setting this kid up. But like, as hard as that conversation felt in that moment to you, you've set up an even harder conversation that's going to happen in about 18 months. So I wrote this song called Everybody Dies that was meant to be a celebration song, like a song partly for kids, partly for grownups, just normalizing that we're going to die. So much of my enjoyment of life and the vigor with which I attack life comes from an understanding of my own mortality. There is an urgency. There is an urgency, you know, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. So I try and just, again, it's like supporting the kids in an acknowledgement of how mysterious this is, and that how do you make sense of this experience in the face of this great unknown? There's no one answer to it. We try many different things. We try distraction. We try looking at it directly. We try ambition to be bigger than it. We try desperation and despair. And, you know, human beings have remarkable strategies for coping with the unknown. And, you know, it's also like whatever gets you through the night, like John Lennon said. But acknowledging it does feel like respectful. And I think with kids, it's funny because they look to us to have answers, but in the face of death, we actually don't have any more answers than they do. So in that way, there's no parents and no children. There's just, we're all brothers and sisters, because we're all equal in that we don't know what the hell's going on and what happens when you die and what happens after you die. And I think a lot of parents resist feeling like equals with their children in that.
My gran was 97. Lived as long as she was able. But my dad went kind of suddenly on an operating table. Well, my neighbor went from heartbreak, 'cause his son went in his prime. And I'm more aware than ever that I'm here on borrowed time. But it's alright, 'cause everybody dies. So tell her what you're feeling when you look into her eyes. Yeah, it's okay, hey, everyone's afraid. So wrap your arms around the one you love tonight, 'cause everybody dies.
Look, we do have to cushion our children slightly, because we have to monitor their emotional maturity and what they're ready to hear about, because there's atrocities that happen in the world that you just do not want for their own emotional well-being, a 3, 4, 5, 6-year-old exposed to certain ideas. But in general, I've sort of had the approach, and this is very general, but I've just had the approach that when they're asking a question, they're ready to hear the answer to it. And you can monitor how you tell that answer. Like, I've been accused of being a little bit too, telling a little bit too much truth in a way that might not be the most sensitive at times. Because I think it is our responsibility to support people in the way they receive information. So yeah, but in general, I think when the kids have asked something, I've felt it's an appropriate time to tell them.
Mm. One of the things that Anthony and I have spoken about a lot, and one of the things that led me kind of into this space myself, was the idea that I feel like as a child growing up in a Holocaust survivor family, that I always knew about death and I always knew about these atrocities. And I can't speak for all Jewish people or descendants of all survivors or victims of the Holocaust, but I feel like we were kind of, that was taken away. And I'm not saying it's any better or any worse, but I think death is something that in some ways our culture and other cultures who've experienced mass genocide and atrocity, something you do have to reckon with from the beginning, because you know Nana and Zeta are sad because someone tried to kill them and killed their whole family. I don't actually know your background in that regards. Did your grandparents survive?
My grandmother left Russia basically like, she went through like the Bolshevik like revolution. Like mm-hmm. She saw a neighbor, a little girl get killed. But she was in Australia then already in the 30s.
Okay.
But yeah, I think it's a mixed experience growing up under the specter of tragedy. It's funny. I was just, my daughter's really into films, and she was asking me all about Spielberg because she thought it was so interesting that he made Jurassic Park and Schindler's List basically back to back. And that is interesting. And she was asking me if I liked Schindler's List. And I said, I went into such a long answer. I was like, I can't tell you in my generation anything to do with the Holocaust. It was held over our heads and beaten into us so intensely that I couldn't even judge that as a work of cinema.
Mm-hmm.
All I was like, there's a Holocaust movie out. We've got to see the Holocaust movie. Everyone see that. It's very sad. It's very important. Spielberg's doing a good thing. See the Holocaust movie. Or everyone needs to see it. It was like, yeah, being that close to sort of tragedy and maybe to mortality, maybe to genocide, it does give you, on one hand, this sense that, oh, death looms near. It's not as abstract a concept. But on the other hand, it also, it colors your experience and sort of the innocence of we're all individual animals that are all within a lifespan, and there are many types of death that we can have, and there are many different scenarios we can find ourselves dying in. I think growing up feeling that basically the inevitability of that, look, everybody wants to kill you. They want to kill everybody like you and everybody in your family. And your job is to marry a Jewish person so that when they kill you, you've at least left a Jewish person in your place. Like that does kind of color your ability to have your own opinion and experience about what your attitude to death and life is. But I think the way Jews have decided that our method of dealing with this trauma is to continually re-traumatize ourselves and make sure generational trauma is passed on, surely there's a better strategy. Surely.
My first experience of death was very formative in how I relate to it. It was a very positive experience, even though someone died. And it kind of set me up to be comfortable, I think, in this space and not as afraid. I know your father died when you were very young. Was that a formative experience?
Yeah, that was very formative for sort of a strange reason. I was living in New York at the time, and I had this night where I was just tossing and turning in bed. Like I couldn't, you know, there's nights where something's sort of on the edge of your consciousness, of your mind. And I was tossing and turning. And then I sat up in the middle of the night, like 4:30 in the morning. And I was like, my dad's going to die soon. Like I just said it that way that like, when you've realized like something that usually about yourself, like I want to quit my job. You know, it's like, I had this moment of like, I just said this thing and I totally relaxed and I went back to sleep. And then the phone rang a little bit after, and it was my sister saying that my dad, who'd had heart issues his whole later life, he'd had like a triple bypass and a tear in his aorta. And she said, dad's back in hospital. They found another tear. And that began sort of this chapter that was the last couple months of his life, and with nothing other than my own sort of gut feeling about it, made the decision to go back and spend some proper time with him, because he'd recovered from all of these heart things before. And everyone was very optimistic because he'd always bounced back. But I just had this feeling he was going to die. So I just had a number of conversations to take place that I might have had my defenses up to in another, without that sort of weird intuitive moment happening. And he did die. And I felt some degree of more like closure with it or peace with it, because I had some degree of preparation. And now I know that life's not always like that, and there's sudden deaths and there's tragedies and there's all, but there was something about just living in the understanding that if he hadn't died then, he was going to die eventually. Like, it was hitting me. It was really hitting me, his mortality. And I went, and as best I could, as a 19-year-old, look, a 19-year-old Australian male is not the kind who is going to be the most emotionally articulate with their father, who's like born in World War II in London, you know, able to have like a real heart-to-heart particularly. But in our way, we had some understanding together and some connection. And I think, I guess maybe that's where the idea of a good death comes in, that in some ways, even though he died, I would have loved him to, you know, meet my wife and my daughter and my stepdaughter. And obviously those would be beautiful things. That being said, to lose someone where you do have some time to contemplate how you want to spend that period, I think that did inform my interest in kind of bringing some kind of consciousness or mindfulness to the process of dying and the value of that.
Yeah, I understand that. I think watching someone die slowly of a terminal illness or over time of a terminal illness is harrowing and complicated, but I at least feel like you get to say everything you want to say. You get, you know, you may not say everything you want to say, but you are given the opportunity to say, I love you, thank you, all of these things.
Yeah, of all the feelings I have about it, I don't feel robbed of that experience. I got the experience to actually say farewell. I got the experience. And even though, because he was going into surgery, he ended up dying in surgery. So, you know, you have to put on a brave face and you're optimistic and you're like, I'll see you after. And, you know, there was a latent understanding that this could very well be a goodbye. Yeah.
And you've said that you've never been to see his grave.
No, I think I have.
Oh, you have.
I don't know. I just like, I sort of don't care about graves. I don't, the honest, the truth is the fact that I can't remember it. Like I did, I know I was at his funeral. I don't think I was at his stone setting because in Judaism, that's a year later. I have no sense that he's there.
Yeah.
Like I have zero sense of that.
Yeah.
Like to me, I mean, I will probably be cremated. I don't feel like putting the body somewhere is particularly meaningful. It's nice. It's essentially like it's nice if the family wants it and it's for them, basically. It's not really for the person.
Yeah. I feel like I don't go to visit my loved ones' graves that much, and I definitely don't have any feeling that that's where they are physically or intangibly located. But if I feel like I need to tell them something or work through something myself, I will just go there because I can talk to the headstone and it's something. And, you know, there are other places, like sometimes I drive near my childhood home, and this is less and less, you know, as I get older, this is less and less what I do. But, you know, finding a place where you can talk to them or just sit and be with them, I think is important.
I would probably go to the old location of the Bondi Diggers, and go to where the poker machines were, and just remember all his nights coming home from there, drinking beers with his mates down at the Diggers, and just. But now it's just an apartment complex, so I'll just be out there talking to myself.
I know. I think the people started seeing the girl in the car outside the house, just going like, "What is this woman doing?"
So, apart from the pokies, where is your dad for you now?
I think one of the things that I loved about my dad was, for a man, he was actually very physically affectionate. Like, I remember him hugging me a lot, and I remember like watching TV, like in his arms, and that kind of masculine tenderness and sensuality is something that I didn't realize until I got older was sort of rare.
Mm.
And I've been a very tactile person with my kids, and that was never weird or foreign. So in that way, I think the way I like to physically connect and to touch and show affection that way, like I feel like almost like the genealogy in that tactile expression.
Mm, that's lovely. Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about the time you played music for a recently bereaved family?
Oh, yeah.
And what that was like and how that came about?
Yeah. I think that what's interesting is with the hospice volunteering, how the line between supporting the person who was dying and supporting their family was actually much blurrier than I initially thought. It all does seem to kind of go together because you're working to some degree. If the person has a family who's present, you're kind of connected with them, like you're kind of a member of their team. And going back to the idea of not rushing the body out and not making it this alien, scary, diseased thing, you know, that it was quite, it used to be quite normal for the body to remain for a few days at least in the house. So anyway, this was a scenario where there was a family, I think it was a Mexican Catholic family, and they had a viewing for a day of the body, and they had it set up in this sort of tent kind of thing outside. It was beautifully decorated, and people were just coming in one at a time and spending a minute, and they said, would I want to come and play some guitar? And I just played, you know, very quiet. It's not a particular moment you want a spotlight on you or want to do anything too intrusive. But again, that sense of just being there and how underrated that is in our culture.
Yeah.
Like we're such an achievement-oriented species, and everything is basically either adding or subtracting to the GDP. You know, everything's just monetizable. And like the idea of just presence, of being there with people as they go through something, and using music for that was really interesting to me. It's an experience I think about a lot. Like there's times when I'm on stage where, I don't know, you feel like you might be losing the room a little, or a song's not going as well as you want, or, you know, whatever the type of value judgment the performers put on themselves. And then you just sort of go, I'm standing here making sounds, and these people are standing here too, and they've each got their own problems, and I really don't have to do anything else.
Yeah.
I was just, while listening to you, I was reflecting on when my own mother died, and she died in hospice, and they invited us to be with the body afterwards. And it was a kind of uncanny experience, actually, but so important to be there with family, with the body. I'd never been in a room with a dead body before. So that in itself was unusual and a bit unsettling, but at the same time struck me as being so crucial to the grieving process.
Yeah, I didn't like it when my dad died, because he died in surgery, and then they like sew the person up and you're in a hospital. I actually felt quite nauseous when I went in, and it just felt like this was not at all a peaceful setting that was contemplative or anything. It was like a room off the ER type thing. And yeah, I didn't get to experience that much with my dad, but it's something that it's not always, and not for everybody is it the right experience, but I think there is something about it grounds things.
Yeah.
It just makes it concrete and real and something that is very abstract.
And it makes it, I think, not scary. I mean, maybe in your situation, like that's more surgical and medical and clinical and cold. And I know for my loved ones who have died when I wasn't around, I've opted not to see the bodies. But I have seen, I saw one, my paternal grandmother, I was there when she died, so I saw her become a dead body. And then my other grandmother, my maternal grandmother, died in hospice, and my sister was there. And my sister called me because, as you know, as our listeners may not know, a Jewish body is not meant to be left alone at any point between death and burial. It's supposed to always have an accompaniment.
And there are volunteers who sit with the bodies until they get buried, even overnight.
And my sister called me. My sister's not good with this stuff, and was like, she was in the hospice. She was like, you have to come now. Like, I'm sitting here. And seeing Nana for me was beautiful. It was, you know, it was still a clinical and medical experience. But again, she didn't look like Nana anymore. Like, all the Nana was gone. But
no, that's what's so weird, isn't
yeah.
it?
It's, yeah. Like she looked, you know, they physically resemble who they were, but like, you know, that you can just see they're not there anymore, like whatever it yeah. is. But again, like it's just another thing that it takes the fear away, and it is beautiful being with a dead body. And if I had the chance again to wash and prepare and have in home, my mum died at home, but in a hospital bed with medical care. But I would definitely jump on the chance to kind of repersonalize that experience for sure.
Yeah, I think it can be a very tender, I mean, I've never done that. I haven't had any close to me die where I've helped prepare the body, but I've heard people say it can be quite a tender, intimate experience for the loved ones. Yeah.
I wondered if we can sort of move in a slightly different direction, which is back to your spiritual seeking, which is important thread in your life and in your creative work. You've described yourself as a spiritual seeker, and you draw inspiration from different religions. One concept from Tibetan Buddhism, which has inspired you, is the idea of practicing dying. What does that look like?
I think it just looks like, it just means that whatever happens that day and wherever life goes, you let go and go with it. I mean, that's to me is practicing dying, is practicing letting go. And I don't think it has to be a very elaborate thing dressed up in rituals. It's about, you know, you get to the airport and you're too late for the plane and you've missed it by 5 minutes. Do you have a total panic attack, or do you reassess and make a new decision? And you experience a death. That was a death of that plan, mm-hmm. you know? And I think that's practicing dying.
Mm. And I've heard you mention before the idea of a psychological death or a mystical death.
Yeah, that's the mystical death or psychological death is like something from shamanism. They talk about it in a lot of different cultures. And in psychedelic states or altered states of consciousness, there does seem to be, like, you know, in dreams, there are common symbols. Mm. Like there's a lot of times people will dream of like the old mysterious woman, or the, you know what I mean?
Teeth are really important, apparently.
Or the room, yeah, the room in the house that they never found. You know, there are these symbols that are like really archetypal. There's a type of death that people go through in these states where you can't remember your name or identity or any of the things that you've held onto about yourself and you've identified with. They've become foundational to your experience. They're gone, and you let go. And in a lot of shamanic cultures, they talk about it almost like you're pulled apart by spirits, like limb from limb, and then you're rebuilt. And it's a more dramatic way of saying what we just said about missing the plane at the airport. You know, it's a real balancing act, life. Like on one hand, I have to wake up as Ben Lee, and I have to look at Ben Lee's calendar. I have to prepare Ben Lee's kid's lunch, and I have to take her to school. And I have to do all my obligations as this identity, right? But there's this other thing happening in parallel where I don't know who the hell I am or what the hell I'm meant to be doing. Mm. And that is the death that's happening in every moment. And it's the secret that we carry around with each of us, that none of us know what the hell is going on. And when we're either forced into that through something surprising, it can be tragic, it can be positive, it can just be expansive. Or when we lean into it through practices like meditation or psychedelics, we experience that death and we are rebuilt again. And we then reapproach the iCal with a somewhat, hopefully, slightly more detached approach to our obligations, and maybe even I think the light touch that comes with experiencing a death of your ego can be really positive for your life.
Mm-hmm. I would just like to say that knowing your life and what's probably in your iCal, I will happily become Ben Lee for any amount of time that you want to just like sublet yourself to me.
It was like being John Malkovich.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask, I know that this is something that's constantly evolving and you don't want to dictate your death, but have you and Ione, your beautiful wife, discussed anything in terms of wishes, both either before or after passing?
I mean, we've talked about it. I think we both would like to be cremated.
Mm-hmm.
I not really. I mean, you know, when you're a parent of younger kids, your sort of main concern is like, oh, who's going to take care of them? And I want all my creations. I want the management of those, whether if there's money to be made from it or if there's not, that should be the responsibility of my kid. But we haven't kind of gone into it all that much. It's weird. I think we sort of like don't care that much. Mm. That, like, I see it as like, if I die, I would like Ione to do whatever she wants to do, to celebrate or memorialize it or not, in a way that would make her happy and the family and friends happy. I don't see it as a thing that would be for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she pretty much feels similarly, that like, this is, neither of us particularly feel the need to dictate that. I want to be, you know, my coffin to be carried along to Tub Thumping by Chumbawamba or something like that.
I'm going to send this to Ione and be like, this is what he wanted. You have to do this. It's a good
death. You mentioned a good death earlier, Ben. Do you know what that looks like for you?
No, because it seems totally personal. Mm. It's similar to having birth choices, that there are people that want home births. There are people that want to be in hospital close to the emergency room in case anything goes wrong. And there's everything in between. There's people that want to like basically pull the baby out while they're standing up. You know,
that was my preference, I think, too.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the only question that really has value is what is a good death to you?
Yeah.
And that may also evolve as you live your life. It probably will. I can only speak from my psychedelic experiences, which is probably the closest thing I've experienced to dying. We don't know that it's that similar, but it's as close in the sense that there is a complete surrender of control, a massive terror because of the unknown. And I imagine that there's got to be elements of that in dying. And I guess my hope is that I have courage and that I can relax. And I don't want to really particularly, I don't imagine dictating what that looks like, oh, what kind of light is in the room and are the windows open? And because I do think when you're going into a very personal internal space, you're not that concerned with what's going on externally. I just hope internally, I hope I feel brave enough to relax and pay attention. That's my hope.
Would you like to choose when you die?
No, not really. I mean, I'm saying this now without having a terminal illness or without being in massive pain. It's like, it's very hard to imagine what that's like in that setting. Mm. You know, I love nature and I love the unexpected sort of quality of nature. Mm. And to me, like I've always said with my career, my failures have been more interesting to me and I've learned more than my successes. Because it's when life is out of your control that you sort of like have to, you know, man up, to use a phrase. Like you have to kind of like, you have to basically like face the tremendous tidal wave that is human experience without controlling it. And I aspire to embrace my death in the same way. But I, again, it's all, this is incredibly naive as someone who's, you know, a healthy 44-year-old man who isn't seeing that on the horizon, particularly right now. So I reserve the right to change my answer.
we'll come back in 30 years and ask you the same question.
Thank you. Thank you.
And on that note, Ben, thank you for coming on the show.
That's a pleasure.
So that was Ben Lee.
Yeah, what a fascinating guy.
Thoughts?
My thoughts. Well, he is clearly a very thoughtful person, and I really love the way that he weaves his creativity and his spiritual life together. Mm-hmm. Kind of reminded me of various people that have said, you know, you should make of your life an artwork, like Henry Miller said that. What about you?
For me, I'm going to be thinking for quite a while about the way we memorialize and uphold the Holocaust.
Mm.
His comment on, you know, surely there's a better way to do this than just re-traumatizing ourselves constantly holds weight with me.
Yeah.
And I think that the answer might lie somewhere in between what we're doing and what he's saying.
Yes.
And I'm just going to have to sit with that for a while and think about that.
Maybe for the rest of your life.
Maybe for the rest of my life.
I know we're almost done, Nadine, but there's something you and I really need to do.
We've asked all our guests what a good death means to them, but now it's our turn. It's a good death. So what does a good death mean to you?
That's a very good question, and thank you for asking. I think that, you know, you can say the things that have already been mentioned a lot by our guests on this show, you know, having your loved ones around you and it being painless and all of those things, and having watched multiple people die painful, torturous deaths. I want it to be quick, and possibly I don't want to be expecting it to happen. But if that's not the case, then I want to be able to make an active choice when I'm ready to go. And you?
Yeah, I feel similar to you. Fast and Glorious.
the unknown Vin Diesel movie.
Yeah, exactly. Doesn't have to involve a car, but it probably should. And I guess for me, agency is really at the core. You know, listening to all the different answers we've heard over the last many episodes, I've learnt a lot and seen all those different perspectives. But for me, I want that moment to be kind of intentional. You know, assisted dying is one thing. People tend to think about that in terms of terminal illness. But I'm talking about having an agency when you're on the cusp of your best health, but you're at the end of a pretty full life. And it's kind of like that liminal moment where you get to choose when you go, if possible. So I'm hoping for a readiness at that time to be able to make that transition.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And I can't believe it, but this has been our last episode. Before we sign off, Anthony, any parting words, insights, learnings?
Yeah, can I say two quick things that surprised me?
Sure.
Number one, pigs.
There are a lot of pigs.
A lot of pigs. They don't fare so well, those sad science kebabs. They don't do well. I'm sorry. And number two, you know, it's amazing how uplifting it can be talking about death for so many months with so many wonderful people. So that has just filled my cup and I'm hooked.
Awesome.
Yeah. Do you have a eulogy for the podcast, perhaps?
Ooh. Here lies Grave Matters. It died doing what it loved.
Yes.
And we're done. Hugh Boys to Men's End of the Road.
We have come to the end of the road.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow. I might get a bit teary.
I went there.
you really did. But seriously, thanks again to non-practicing death doula Ben Lee and to all our amazing guests.
And thank you for joining us on this weird and wonderful journey. And we're hoping you've enjoyed it as much as we have.
Amen.
If this episode has raised issues for you and you'd like to seek mental health support, you can contact Beyond Blue on 1300 224636, or visit beyondblue.org.au. Also, Embrace Multicultural Mental Health supports people from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds. Visit embracementalhealth.org.au. For 24/7 crisis support, call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Or in an emergency, please call 000.
Grave Matters is an SBS podcast written and hosted by me, Anthony Levin, and Nadine J. Cohen. Produced by Jeremy Wilmot. The SBS team is Carolyn Gates, Joel Supple, and Max Gosford. If you'd like to get in touch, email audio@sbs.com.au. Follow and review us wherever you find this podcast.
To reset. Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.